yes, as my tribanders were saying, as we have been saying all day, what we're doing today is we're celebrating the enlightenment of the Buddha. Well, what does that mean? I'll say a little bit about what that might mean, just to give us a flavour of that. And then, yeah, there's some particular things I want to say. Yes, just to re-emphasise what Maitreya Banda said, we're celebrating a human being becoming an enlightened human being. That's very, very important, actually, that enlightenment is, well, part of human potential. As Maitreya Banda says, it's not a separate thing added on. So we're celebrating Prince Siddhartha, as he was, becoming the Buddha, the one who is awake, a human being becoming an enlightened human being. And on this day, we're kind of celebrating a particular event, which is, the real day was a full moon day, which is a few days ago, of the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. There's a whole quest leading up to this particular event that we had earlier with the children's drama. They took us on the quest, so very lovely to see the children from the Sunday school enacting the drama of the Buddha after he went forth from the palace. Had all the adventures that are an integral part of any quest, and arrived under the Bodhi tree, and we heard that he sat down and he made a vow that he would not rise from this spot until he had realised enlightenment or died in trying. So this is what I want to talk about. The whole of my talk is going to be situated under this Bodhi tree. And I think, although I said there's a whole quest before that, you could also see that what happens under the Bodhi tree is the whole quest as well, actually. If we think of our lives, I mean, this is why we tell the story of the Buddha in the first place. It's because, you know, it's because of the resonance with our own human life. So the Buddha is a human being who realises the fullness of human potential. We tell that story because it's a resonance. It plays the same strings as in our being. So the whole thing happens under the Bodhi tree, you could say, in a certain sense. So the first thing that happens when he sits under the Bodhi tree is he confronts and he transcends, he goes beyond the fundamental forces that drive us as human beings. So he confronts and transcends greed and hatred and pride. So there, that's what drives us. Unenlightened, that's what drives us. Kind of in a sense, no matter how good we are, no matter how generous we might be for a while, no matter how calm we might be for a while, we always kind of, in the end, while we're unenlightened, come back to what's in it for me. We come back to what do I stand to lose, and we come back to what do people think of me. We always eventually come back to those three. We do, don't we? Well, I do, so I imagine that we do. So we come back to what's in it for me, what do I stand to lose, and what do people think of me? The important thing about Buddhism is it doesn't judge us for that. It's not saying that we're bad people somehow for that. It's just that's... it's hard to say this because I keep wanting to say that's just how we are, but it's kind of the real truth is that's why we are is because we're driven by that. That's how we've come into this human existence. Unenlightened, we're driven by those three things. And Buddhism isn't judging us, but what Buddhism is saying is that's limiting. It's limiting to be. Well, it is, isn't it? Just when you say it, you can feel the limitation of that. When you kind of, you spin back to what's in it for me. Sort of disappointing sense of that. So that's what happens when the Buddha sits under the tree. These three forces, they come and attack him, really. And we have this dramatised, we had it a little bit in the children's drama, we have it dramatized as an attack from outside. We've got this figure called Mara, who is the sort of easy way to sort of gloss Mara is a personification of all the forces that hold us back. So that's what Mara is, everything that holds us back. It's kind of death, death to growth, really. Like the weed killer, I suppose, to the acorn or something. So that's how it's dramatised. But you could see that these are the forces within us all, and they come and attack the Buddha. So again, as those of us that were here for the drama earlier, so hatred is represented by armies hurling weapons and so on, come and attack the, well, he's not the Buddha yet, Siddhartha, Prince Siddhartha, as he's sitting there on the brink of enlightenment, he's represented as attacked by armies. And you've got this sort of beautiful, lovely thing of, he doesn't fight back, you know, he just sits there. This is all hurled at him. And as all the weapons touch his aura, they're transformed to flowers that just rain down as offerings. Very, 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 very beautiful and kind of worth pondering on image. I was thinking the closest thing I've sort of experienced to this, I don't know if you've ever, you know what it's like when you're like really angry with somebody? Maybe you don't, I do anyway. When you go to something, you're really, really annoyed at them. You say, you did this and you did that, and you did this. And then they say, yeah, I did, I'm sorry. And you're kind of, you're defeated in a sense, but you're not defeated by them. The wind's taken out of your sails, isn't it? You can't. You know, they just say, oh, I'm sorry. And all your weapons just kind of, you know, they just fall to the ground. They haven't done anything. So I think why I thought of that was because how the way that the Buddha sort of defeats that army of hatred is because the Buddha, or the Buddha to be on the brink of enlightenment, has sort of realized that there is nothing to defend. There's no defensiveness. Because there's nothing to defend, yeah? So there's no purchase, yeah? There's no purchase to hatred. It just turns to flowers. So if the first of all, hatred is defeated. And then again, as we saw earlier on, craving arises. So in the external form, well, the children were sweet. The temptation was of children with toys. We usually, the more traditional account is the Mara tries to seduce the Buddha with his daughters. Yeah. So, and again, that makes no impression. Again, the Buddha doesn't, Siddhartha doesn't turn a hair, and he's just completely unaffected by the temptations represented by these dancing girls. So, you know, you can substitute for dancing girls, you know, whatever might tempt you. And again, you might have had experience of that. Sometimes after a retreat, particularly if you've been on a retreat, just sitting quietly for a week or two or three or more, you might find, I sometimes find this, if the retreat's gone well, when I step out back into the world, as it were, all the things that usually seduce me just don't have that power anymore. I don't need to resist them, they just don't have that power. Mm-hmm. I remember a strong instant of this was a friend of mine, Lee Lamini, some of you will know her, and she thinks she is, by her own definition, she loves things. She loves everything. She's the most easy person in the world to buy a birthday present for because she just loves everything. She loves cakes. She loves, she just loves everything. So she's very, very, you know, she just likes things. And she was on a three-month retreat in Spain. And she came back to our community. We lived together. And she said, we came off the retreat and we were in Barcelona and I just didn't want anything. It was amazing, you know. So just that experience of not wanting anything, there was no effort. And her, you know, and the delight. It's a positive mental state, just like not wanting. So Siddhartha is, you know, something like that, although, you know, much, much more. So he, craving has no, you know, no purchase anymore. And then, of course, Mara tries his last trick, and he whispers in Siddhartha's ear, "Who do you think you are?" Again, we have that enacted by the children. Who do you think you are? We usually talk about this as doubt, which it is. Mara's trying to plant the seed of doubt, that self-doubt. It's kind of a form of pride as well. Pride is interesting. Pride. Often we think of pride as when we think we're sort of above ourselves, but it's anything that's self-referential. I remember a little story I often tell. Someone went to see our own teacher, Bhante Sangharakshita, and said, "Oh, you know, meditation, everyone else can meditate. Everybody else is like getting on really well with their meditation, but it's just not working for me, and it's never going to work." And Bhante said, "Oh, what makes you so special?" Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's that kind of pride can also be, it's when we self-reference ourselves to think, "I'm specially good, but also I'm specially bad in a way, I can't do it." And that's what Mara was trying to see if there was any of that left in the Buddha by saying, "Who do you think you are?" It didn't work, of course. What the Buddha does famously is he touches the earth with his right hand, and the earth goddess rises, and she bears witness on all his practice, traditionally throughout lifetimes, all his skillful, generous, positive actions throughout lifetimes. And so Mara's defeated. The Buddha's called the earth goddess to witness those actions. And again, you've got a bit like Maitreya Banda was saying with the metaphor of the acorn, you've got that earth goddess showing that enlightenment is natural. If you practice all these perfections over a long time, enlightenment will be the outcome of that. It's implicit in our nature as human beings. It's not automatic. So I suppose that's what it's unlike the acorn in a way, because it's more conscious than the acorn. It's not automatic, but it's completely natural. I think what that earth goddess is showing is that Buddhism's complete and utter faith in human nature. So that all happens. So there you've got a being who is completely free of greed, hatred, and pride for the first time ever. In humanity, you've got a being who's completely free of greed, hatred, and pride. It's completely earth-shattering, and we're told in the legendary accounts that the earth does tremble and vibrate. So no human being's ever done that before. It's like a completely new type of consciousness has been born, a consciousness that doesn't circle back to that sort of limitation of, you know, what's in it for me? What have I got to lose? What do people think of me? That kind of tight consciousness is completely free of that. It's kind of unimaginable, presumably, to us if we haven't realised it. I certainly am nowhere near it, but, you know, it's completely unimaginable, apart from perhaps every now and then you get little glimpse of a glimpse of a glimpse of a glimpse, but a new type of consciousness is born. It's like, but that was always there in potential. It's sort of mysterious, that, isn't it? That we live in a universe where that is possible. So it's like, you can imagine the universe itself wanting to kind of shout with joy for that something that was there in potential has actually been realised. Like the universe knows itself fully for the first time. It's very mysterious, isn't it? It could only be known through a person. It's a bit like, I always think it's a bit like poetry. Like, where was the poem before it was written? It sort of existed in potential, but it had to be made into form to exist. But we live in a universe where poetry is possible and where Buddhas are possible. So that's all happened. So that's earth-shattering, completely earth-shattering. But what the most important thing that I want to talk about today is that's not the end, yeah? That's not the end. That's not the end of the experience. What we call enlightenment isn't yet complete at this point. And that's because what we call enlightenment isn't just about stopping. It isn't just about cessation. It isn't just about the end of things. It is about them, but it's not just about them. It's not just about freeing ourselves from you know, this mind that circles round and round in that way. It's also about this emergence of a new type of consciousness. And what that is, what it's a bit like Maitreya Banda was saying in the expression of the positive precepts, how that manifests. So I want to look at what happened next. And this all happened under the tree. I think that's quite significant as well. The Buddha doesn't just suddenly jump up and go, right, that's it, I'm enlightened, and off he goes. He does eventually go to his friends, as Maitreya Banda said, but he stays under that tree and more happens. And the more that happens is part of it. So there's two main things that happen. Well, actually, there's quite a lot of things that happen, but there's two that I'm going to focus on. There's quite a few things, but there's two that I'm going to focus on. So the two that I'm going to focus on are the Buddha's... Well, sometimes it's talked about as a thought, but I think it's not. It's more than a thought. It's the Buddha's sense of how am I going to communicate this? So the Buddha, this experience happens, and the Buddha has this, like, how am I going to communicate this? And even, can I communicate this? So that happens. And also the Buddha has, again, you could say a thought, but it's much more than a thought. It's who can I revere? Yeah, so these two things are two things that happen. How am I going to communicate this, and who can I revere? In the tradition of the counts, we're told that these are sort of distinct in time. Actually, the who can I revere apparently happens first, and then how can I communicate this happens later on, some weeks later. This whole thing is meant to take 7 weeks. But I think, I've been thinking about this quite a lot recently, and I think they're aspects of the same thing. So although they're told as distinct in time, I think they're the same thing. And I think what that thing is I think, well, trying to imagine what it must have felt like to be the Buddha, which is quite hard, but there you are. You're sitting under this tree. You've practiced all these lifetimes, maybe. You have practiced towards this. You've made this vow. You've sort of defeated these forces of Mara. But still, when enlightenment happens, it must just feel like, what's happened? You know, it must just feel like, what's happened? What's just happened, you know? And I think in that feeling of what's just happened, I think it would just make you look, you'd look up and you just think, where did that come from? You know, even though you've been, in a sense, you've been preparing for it and working toward it, there'd still be this like, where did that come from? And then simultaneously it'd be like, how am I ever going to sort of explain this or tell it to anyone? And I think that's kind of part of the same thing. I can only, if I try and think of it in my own life, obviously I can only think of my own life in a much more mundane sort of glimpse of a glimpse of a glimpse of a glimpse kind of way. Actually, I was talking to Maitreya Banda about this, or he was talking about it, and I was listening, rather. And I think the only thing I can compare it to is if when you're trying to do something artistic. I remember I write poems, or try to write them. Anyway, I was trying to write this poem. Actually, it was a poem. It was also a poem from Maitreya Banda, as it happens. I was trying to write it. You know what it's like if you're trying to, if you ever tried to do anything like that, paint or write or or it could be that formally, or even formally artistic, but even if you're trying to find the right words to express something, you know, there's that kind of, oh, I'm never going to get this right, and why do people say this is pleasurable? It's actually like torture, you know. Probably Gus felt like that on the Shroud Office too last night. You're making it, remaking it. And I was trying to, you know, I really wanted to write this poem for my tribe, and it was important to me to do it. And I was, oh, it was all wouldn't work. And then I just thought, oh, I'm going to just try this thing my writing teacher said. I was kind of thinking, I don't think it'll work, but I'll just try it. And I tried it. And then suddenly, it was a poem. And I suddenly thought, oh my God, like, there it is. So it was that, like, oh, where did that come from? And also, wasn't it exactly, I won't be able to tell him, but I won't be able to do it again. And I think that's just quite right, because in a sense, it wasn't me who did it, and it wasn't even my writing teacher who did it. It was a kind of mixture of, I'd learned something from the teacher. I really, you know, had a heartfelt wish to do this poem for my Tree of Vendor. I'd tried, like, all week to do it. And then suddenly something just happens that simultaneously got, oh, that look up, where did that come from? And also, gosh, I don't think I'd be able to describe how I did that if anyone asked me at the same time. So I think this, that's why I think these two incidents of the Buddha thinking, who am I going to revere and how am I going to communicate this, are they're like part of the same thing. I think they're exactly symmetrical. Like, one's kind of looking up and one's, well, when I'm going to say looking down, I don't mean that in any sort of pejorative way. I mean, it's what we've later come to call the Buddha's compassion. It's interesting. Later on in Buddhism, where the whole teaching of bodhisattvas developed, there's the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, a name for him is the Lord who looks down. So you've got this, you look down in compassion and you kind of look up in reverence. So I think they're kind of exactly symmetrical, these two, what I call them, incidents. It's not even right to call them incidents, but just call them that. And I think the significance is that the truth that's discovered, the Dharma as we call it, doesn't stop with a person. I said the Buddha is a human being, but it doesn't stop with a person and it doesn't start with a person. Even for a Buddha, it doesn't stop with the Buddha. There's this sort of looking down and compassion. And even for a Buddha, it doesn't start with the Buddha. To think either of those would be to, well, it wouldn't be the Dharma anymore. It would completely, you know, it would just make it into something else that wasn't the Dharma. So it doesn't stop with the Dharma. If it really is the Dharma, it doesn't stop with you and it doesn't start with you, even for a Buddha. So the Buddha, in the terms of the story, the Buddha kind of resolves these things. So if in terms of the teaching, he does think of people he can teach. He does realize that he will be able to teach. And as Maitreya Banda said, actually it's quite good you said that, because I'm not going to say that, but he goes to his friends teaches his friends. What I'm going to talk about for the rest of this talk is this instinct to look up, and where that's related in the Buddhist scriptures is in a sutta called the Garava Sutta, and that's what I want to explore. So this is actually, it's actually written down, as I say, in a sutta or a discourse. So Garava, the word Garava means reverence and respect. So that's the most common translation of it. Bhante, our teacher, Bhante Sangharachitta, he puts a bit more onto it. He says it's got admiration and wonder. So again, you've got that looking up. And here's an interesting thing Bhante says. He says, it's delight in the fact that there exists or existed others superior to oneself in creative ability or spiritual attainment. So that's interesting, isn't it? Delight in the fact that there exists or existed others superior to oneself in creative ability or spiritual attainment. I thought that was quite interesting because I don't always feel that in relation basically to people that, well, basically said to people that are better than you. I don't always feel that. In a less than positive mental state, I don't always feel delight in that there exists others that are superior to me in a creative ability or spiritual attainment or anything at all for that matter. So I think in my, I think the exact opposite of that's jealousy. I don't these days feel out and out jealousy so much, although it's not unknown to me, and I certainly have felt it in the past. What I more often feel is, I think Harold Bloom, I don't know if he was the first to call it the anxiety of influence, yeah? So in relation to people that I know or suspect are superior to me, I feel a sort of anxiety of influence. I feel like I'm going to be shown up. You know, if I'm teaching, say, at the centre, I feel, oh, you know, I wish they weren't there because I it's making me anxious to have someone who's better than me sort of there. Do people know that? Am I? Well, good. I'm glad. I was reassured to know you're not the only one. So I think that's the sort of anxiety of influence. So, I have recently experienced though the opposite of that. It was when I was on retreat. Recently, I experienced the opposite of that. I experienced something more like what Bhante said. And I mean, I guess I was in a more positive mental state. It's interesting, you don't always know you're in a positive mental state or a negative one for that matter until something happens, don't you? So I think this little incident that happened probably meant that I was in a positive mental state, presumably because I was on retreat. I was co-leading a retreat and I realised that the person I was co-leading it with was in fact superior to myself in both creative ability, and the fact they were a better teacher, and in spiritual attainment. I felt that they knew the Dharma better than me, and they were better at teaching it. And I was delighted. I just realised I felt delighted. And I felt delighted in three different ways. That the first two are easy and the third's a bit more difficult to explain. So I was just happy. I thought, oh, this is great. I'm learning. I'm learning from this person. So that was quite simple. I felt I was delighted to have been learning, just to have been taught. I felt delighted that I was being positively challenged because I was also teaching on this retreat, and it stretched me in a way that was actually pleasurable. I thought, okay, so Bhadramati, you know, you could rise to this, you know. So I was positively challenged. But I think the third thing was a bit more like what Bhante's getting at. I don't know if I'm quite going to be able to put it into words because it was quite subtle. That I could sort of, it was something like I could recognise superiority and be joyful about that. I kind of felt, what it felt like, it's like I'd found a new species of positivity. You know how like you might find a new species of wildflower or something like that? I thought, oh, what's that feeling? I've not had that before. And I thought, oh, it's something like, it's quite hard, it's a bit hard to talk about your own positive mental states, but it was like, oh, good, I can recognise that. That's good, isn't it? Oh, that's good. You know, so something about the very fact of being able to recognise it just felt pleasurable. So I think that's maybe what Gaurava is. It's the delight in the fact that they're actually, just in the sheer existence, that there are people that are better than oneself and that you can recognise it. Do you see? Do you see what I mean? And that you can recognise it is a positive thing in itself. So that's what Gaurava is getting at. this reverence and respect, but it's a bit more subtle than that. So interestingly enough, in the sutta, the key thing that the Buddha says, because he is the Buddha by now, he's a fully enlightened human being, and he says to himself, it's painful to live without honouring and respecting anyone. Yeah. So the Buddha says, who am I going to look up? There's this instinct to look up, but he's saying, who am I going to look up for, up to? Because it's painful to live without honour and respecting anyone. So I thought that's an interesting question to ponder. Do we think that's true for a start? So we'll leave aside the fact that he's the Buddha and what that means, but is it even true for us? I'll come back to the fact that he's the Buddha later. But is it true that it's painful to live without honour and respecting anyone? I mean, I don't know. Do we think it is? We might kind of go, well, fine, actually. Do you know what I mean? I'm fine. I don't need to honour and respect anyone. I don't feel it as painful. And I think what might help us here, I'm going to just give us a little bit of Dharma teaching kind of definition. In the traditionally Buddhism talks about three kinds of pain or three kinds of suffering. This might get us closer to what the Buddha meant. So there's so if it's suffering to live without honouring and respecting anyone, what can that mean? So the three kinds of suffering are the kind of suffering that's suffering. So that's like, you know, just the suffering of like, well, I've got backache just now. It's the suffering if you've got backache when you don't want, you know, well, I suppose no one wants to have it, the suffering of loss, you know, you lose someone or some, well, someone particularly that you really love, they die, they leave you. There's that kind of very direct suffering. There's also what's called, it's called suffering by way of transformation. What it means is, it means that you're perfectly happy at the moment, but you actually know that the things that make you happy are not going to last, which actually is everything in this mundane world. So you become aware that your relationship to the thing of pleasure can't last. I remember talking to my sister, my youngest sister, and I asked her, why were we talking about this? It sounds like a very deep and meaningful talk. We were talking about when we first became aware of our own mortality. And she says she became aware of her own mortality at the moment when her son was born. She said that was the moment when I realised life was finite. So do you see how that's a suffering by way of transformation? She, of course, it's a very joyful event in her life. She's now got this son. But then instantly she knew that there would be a parting. You know, she knew she would die. Presumably she also, you know, or that one of them would die. She took it upon herself that she would die. It could be him, you know, but they're both alive now. But she became aware. That was when she knew that life was finite. So that's the second kind of suffering. Do you see how it takes a bit more imagination to that? But then the third kind of suffering is the suffering of conditioned existence itself. So this is the existential suffering. So this is, in fact, even to be aware of this kind of suffering, I think is a spiritual progress. I don't just think it, as I know it, as even to be aware of that, it's kind of where the spiritual life begins. It's where the Buddha's spiritual life began. It's what started the Buddha on his quest. It's when, at the beginning, for those of you who don't know the story, the Buddha was a prince. He had everything. So he didn't have the suffering. He didn't really even have the suffering of transformation because he was protected from that by his father. So he never saw old age, sickness or death. So he didn't even have that. But there was a corner of his heart that wasn't satisfied because somewhere he knew, and we know if we pay enough attention, that there's something greater, something further. And that's very, very positive, actually. It's to be cherished when you realise that. It's where the spiritual life begins. So I think when the Buddha's talking about that it's painful to live without honouring or respecting anyone, that it's suffering, it probably means something more like that third kind of suffering. And I think that's important. Otherwise, we'll just dismiss what the Buddha said. We'll just say, well, no, it isn't. Like, I'm fine. You know, I don't need anyone to honour or revere. I think another way of putting it, though perhaps is simpler, is just to think that, well, relative to us, from the point of view of enlightenment, from the point of view of Buddha, our experience is limited. I'm very, very struck by that, just reading some of the Mitra statements out on the notice board. A few people have said that having come across the Dharma and practiced the Dharma, that they've realised ways of being that were previously unimaginable to them. So do you see, but I mean, if you'd said to them then, back then, were you suffering, they might have said no. But then something on that they couldn't yet imagine happens. And then you, so relative to that, there's a, you could even call it painful or certainly limited state of mind relative to this new as yet. From that point of view, unimagined, but from, do you see what I mean? Looking back, you see what was previously limited. So I think when we think of this question of is it painful to live without honouring or respecting anyone, we may have to use our imaginations to see in what way is it painful. So, be that as it may, in this Garbha Sutta, the Buddha is quite clearly taking it for granted, if you can say such a thing of a Buddha, that a sense of reverence is essential, yeah? And that the sense of reverence increases spiritual qualities. So I think you've got something very important here, which is that enlightenment, although it's ground-shaking and momentous, it's not the end point. In some sense, it's an end, because it's the end of greed, hatred, and pride or delusion forever. There can never be a return to those things. So in one sense, it's the end. But in another sense, it's not the end, because growth itself is endless. That's the truth of all life, actually, and it's the truth even for a Buddha. I shouldn't say even for a Buddha, more so for a Buddha, that growth is endless. That there's the ways that Buddhahood can manifest, can never come to an end. So enlightenment in that sense is not an end point. So the point here is that this garva, this reverence, this worship is an enlightened quality. Even a Buddha wanted someone to look up to. It's very, very interesting that he looked for someone. Now, the Buddha didn't find someone because by the time of being a Buddha, like he was the highest being. So he didn't find someone. Revered and relied on the truth itself, the Dharma itself, that in the universe that makes Buddhahood possible. But I think the key thing is that he started by looking for someone. So for us, as long as we think we're not the highest being in the universe, it's going to be someone. And that would only be if you were a Buddha. It's going to be someone. So this garva, this reverence, this worship is an enlightened quality. So what that means is that the greater place we can give that in our lives, then the more we're moving towards enlightenment. Everything we call Dharma practice, you know, meditation and practicing generosity, kindness, truthfulness, contentment, and so on, everything we call Dharma practice is simply the way an enlightened being would naturally act. Yeah, so an enlightened being doesn't have to practice these things anymore. They're just a there's just the outpouring of enlightenment itself. They're just completely natural for an enlightened being. As we practice them, our own being has changed, our consciousness is modified, and we move more towards that enlightened state of being. So what I'm emphasizing in this talk is this practice of Gaurava, of reverence, of worship itself. It's an enlightened quality. If we practice it, we move more towards the state of an enlightened being. But then the question is, how are we going to do this? So even if we're convinced that it is a good thing, we can't argue ourselves into it. You can't argue yourself into anything, really. I mean, you probably can a little bit. But we can't argue ourselves into it. So how are we going to... We can only encourage ourselves into it. So what I'm going to say now is just some ways that we can encourage this quality in ourselves. So a very, very simple way of doing this. I mean, it's simple, it's amazing. In some ways, I ask myself, why don't I do this more often myself? With those of us that were here earlier this afternoon, did a little exercise of doing this. It's simply to reflect on the benefits we've received in our lives, especially the benefits from the Dharma, if we're practicing the Dharma. If we reflect enough on the benefits received, it will naturally incline to make us feel grateful, even reverential to those who have brought those benefits to us. So the more we reflect on the benefits we've received, especially from the Dharma in this context, but it can be for anything, well, it can be for life itself actually, then the more we will be inclined to feel certainly gratitude, but even reverence and respect for those that have brought us those benefits. So another way, not another way as distinct from that, sort of complementary, is we can notice when this quality of garva, of reverence, of respect is present, and we can nurture that. So I'm going to say a bit more about this. I've been thinking about this quite a lot. What I've been thinking about is this quality of Gaurava. Well, it's one of a group of positive emotions. That's probably obvious to you. It's connected particularly with Shraddha or faith. In Buddhism, Shraddha or faith doesn't mean blind belief. It's kind of that quality of knowing that life is for something. It's connected with that thing that moves us forward in life, that life is for something. Garva, reverence, is connected with that. It's connected with metta. It's connected with metta, loving kindness, goodwill for beings. In fact, it's what metta becomes in relation to someone we look up to. Gaurava is what metta becomes in relation to someone we look up to. So I said a minute ago that there's this kind of cluster of positive emotions that I want to look at. I use the term positive emotion, but I often think these days that positive emotion isn't the best term for a positive emotion, if you see what I mean. I mean, kind of both bits of it have got problems, actually. Positive's got a bit of a problem to it. In the English language, we often use that as synonymous with the word pleasant, whereas positive doesn't necessarily mean something pleasant. I think it would be better to use the word something like creative or something. It's often pleasant, but it might not be. So positive is not exactly the best word. Emotion also isn't really the best word, because it makes the whole thing sound too much like a feeling. But as we know, metta and Shraddha and Gaurava as well, I'm saying, aren't so much feelings. They will include an emotional feeling aspect, but they aren't to be solely identified with it. Much, much better to think of them as practices rather than feelings. I heard a little story that sort of illustrates that, that I kind of like to tell because I think it's quite good, which is a very simple story of a man goes to his psychiatrist or therapist or something and says, "Oh, I don't love my wife. What should I do?" And the therapist says, "Love her." And he says, "But I don't love her." And the therapist says, "Well, love her." And he says, "But I don't love her." And he says, "Well, love her." And eventually the sort of penny drops that, that love is an action, it's a volition. It's not something you've got or not got, it's something you actually do. So love or metta is a practice. So is Shraddha, and so is this quality of Garva or reverence, this looking up to. And because it's a practice, and not simply a feeling, we can talk about it in three aspects. Again, we can talk about all these so-called positive emotions in three ways. And more and more thinking that that is very, very useful to think of all positive emotion in three ways so that we don't over-identify them with the sort of feeling emotional bit. There is an emotional bit present, but there's also a cognitive aspect and there's also a volitional aspect. I was very struck by this in terms of metta or love. A few weeks ago I was up staying with another one of my sisters. I've got quite a lot of them. I was staying with another one of my sisters and her partner, and their boys, they've got two boys, and both the boys are just teenagers now, and the youngest one, Jack, he's probably not listening to this, so I'm probably allowed to say he's 14. Anyway, his favourite Saturday afternoon activity has become going to the local shopping centre and how they get hold of the cider, I don't know, but they have ways, as I'm sure they do. And well, he said he only drank half the bottle and threw the rest away, but we didn't totally know whether to believe him on that. Anyway, he'd come back home, he'd been at the shopping centre, he'd been drinking his cider. Anyway, he came home and he got in the shower and we were watching a movie and he was singing in the shower and then we were watching the movie and then suddenly we thought, it's gone a bit quiet. And the door was still locked, the shower was still going, and my sister's partner had to unlock the door from the anyway, he'd fallen asleep in the shower. The shower still going. And anyway, they took him to bed. And we carried on watching the movie. But what I noticed was for the whole rest of the evening, every 15 minutes, one of the two of them just went up to check he was okay. I'm sure any of you who are parents would have done the same. And I thought, now to tell you the truth, they're probably not feeling great gushes of love at this moment. They're probably feeling a bit annoyed, perhaps even a bit despairing, you know, a bit worried, like, what? You know, what have we done wrong sort of thing. If I see some people nodding. But do you see how they weren't feeling this big rush? Their action is love, you know. Every 15 minutes they're going up, they're checking. I mean, you know, no, I'm sure most parents would do the same. So I think that's really important to remember this. I think in some ways, maybe this is the most important thing. I want to try and communicate, because I think this is, it's really, if we're trying to identify, it's really important, if we're trying to identify where metta, where shraddha, even where garva, even reverence is present in us, and because if we can identify that, we can nurture it. So it might not be a big gush of feeling. It might be. We might think of the person who's taught us the Dharma, for example, and we might want to prostrate at their feet. We might, you know. I do, actually. But it might not express itself in that way. I was thinking again of another friend of mine, an order member. Actually, it was a person who taught me to meditate. And we both come from the same part of Scotland, but I'm Catholic and he's Protestant. We're both Buddhists, of course, but I'm Catholic and he's Protestant, right? And there's no way that he would ever, I don't think, hope I'm not doing you wrong if you're listening, would throw himself in a prostration at his teacher's feet. I don't think he would do that. At the same time, I know this friend of mine that works day and night for our movement and to spread the Dharma. Yeah, so his actions are reverence. And actually, I was talking to him about this, and he said that so his actions are reverence, and also his, well, the cognitive aspect is present. He said that every single thing Bhante Sangharaj, our teacher, has ever taught, like, hangs together in a way that is totally convincing. So when I say cognitive, I don't just mean you think about it and you think, oh, that sounds good. His whole being, you know, he said that to me. He says it just completely makes sense in his whole being. So do you see, for him, for this friend of mine, you've got reverence in its volitional and cognitive aspects, even though you may not have it in the, you know, may not express itself in that sort of gush of emotion. Another person, it might be more emotional. So why I'm saying this is because the Buddha is saying, actually, life is painful without Garva. So we that's interesting to ponder. How are we going to bring that more quality more in our lives? Also, it's an enlightened emotion. So if we want to be more like the Buddha, how are we going to bring that more in our lives? And I'm saying we can, first of all, we can reflect on benefits received, and then that may result in that. But, and also, we can look at these three aspects and try and identify where it is present, and not over-identify it with a feeling, and just see, well, what am I doing with my life, and what am I sort of assenting to with my being? See where they're present. The third thing we can do is another simple one, which is simply to spend time with people who have access to that, to gratitude and reverence. I particularly remember when I went to India on a pilgrimage to Bodh Gaya, and was with all the Indian order members. So a third of our Sri Ratna Buddhist order are Indian, so a huge sort of movement in India. And it does seem like all the Indian order members and mitras and friends seem to have a more straightforward, easy access to devotion. I tell you, it's catching. You know, it's catching. I certainly found that. I certainly felt like being there just for, well, a week or two, I came back with that increased in myself. So spend time with people who are in touch with it and kind of let them be in touch with it. You know, it's so easy to be cynical, isn't it, in this day and age? Let them be in touch with it and let yourself be infected by it, as it were. So that's three ways that we can cultivate this quality that the Buddha was in touch with under the Bodhi tree. Finally, I want to talk about the relationship with Garva and blessings. Sort of follows on from what I was saying before. So, a very lovely little story a friend of mine told me earlier this year, my friend Holly, who some of you know. She was on retreat at Christmas time, and she was on retreat at Adistana. Now, Adistana is a retreat centre, and it's also where our teacher lives, and he is very old now. He's 91, and actually he's in very good health at the moment, but at Christmas he was in very poor health, and he got rushed off to hospital in the middle of the night with pneumonia and you know, we thought he might die, and he thought he might die, but he didn't die, he survived. But there was a time when it looked like he might die. Now, Holly, my friend, had been hoping to visit him. She just wanted to go and spend a few minutes with him, expressing her gratitude. But she couldn't go because, you know, he was ill, he was in hospital. So what she did was, every day, she came forward to the shrine and she touched her head to the ground in front of a photograph of her teacher in gratitude. And what she said really struck me. She said that as she did that, she said the whole of the Dharma opened up. So in that simple gesture of touching her head to the ground of her teacher, she said the whole Dharma took on new meaning. So that's quite mysterious, isn't it? What actually is happening there? And I'm probably not going to be able to actually explain it, but I can just give you some little hints of what might have been happening. There's an ancient teacher called Milarepa, an ancient Tibetan teacher you might have heard of, and he said this thing. He said, if you look on them with eyes of faith, you will receive a rain of blessings. If you look on them with eyes of faith, you will receive a rain of blessings. So that's rather lovely, isn't it? And I think that was what Holly was experiencing. Her faith, her Shraddha, her Garva was moving her to touch her head to the ground in front of the picture of her teacher who she couldn't see, and she was receiving blessings. The Buddhist word for blessings is adhishtana. And Bhante himself has said, if you put that Milarepa quote more prosaically, you could put it in these words, that Bhante has said that adhishtana is related to your capacity to receive it. You don't exactly have to earn it, but it is related to your capacity to receive it, which is more subtle, isn't it? I think you can compare that to ordinary listening, ordinary communication. You know, I'm sure you've all had this experience, you know, where you've got something quite important you might want to, you wish you could communicate. Say you've been on retreat and you come home. Somebody might ask you, how was your retreat? But you know when they ask you and you can tell they don't really want to know, you know, or they're not really that interested, it's nearly impossible to speak it, isn't it? You sort of try and tell them, but you can't really tell them. But another person asks you, and you know they really mean it, you don't just tell them, but you sort of tell them more than you even knew you had to tell. You know, the better they listen, the more you tell. And you're sort of telling them, but you're sort of telling yourself. It's more is emerging by the quality of their listening. Do people know that experience? So I think this... this thing that Bhante says, adhishtana, is related to your capacity to receive it, and more poetically put by Milarepa, if you look on them with eyes of faith, you will receive a rain of blessings. Is that same principle, but towards someone that you look up to? And what this shows us is that, again, perhaps even better than what I've said already, actually, is that why we might want to cultivate this quality of garva or reverence is it's for us. It'll actually mean that we receive something. It makes it sound too transactional, doesn't it? I can't think of another way of saying it, but it's a bit like... it's like the Buddha doesn't actually need us to be devoted to him. Our teacher doesn't need our devotion. But our teacher, or the Buddha, as it were, will rejoice in our devotion because they'll see that actually it will open us up to the blessings, to more than we have at the moment. That's the mystery of this quality. It's only going to be experienced in relation to somebody who we can look up to. So It's got to be in relation to someone, but in a certain sense, it's not. It's not about them, it's not for them, although it is for them. It is for them, but actually we'll receive the benefit from it. We'll receive the benefit from it. So what I wanted to end with is a poem that I think sort of encapsulates this whole mood, this whole mood of what we mean when we say Gaurava, what the Buddha meant when he says, when he said it's painful not to have someone to revere. But in a way, I think whether the Buddha actually literally said that or not, what I want to leave you with is that instinct of even a Buddha, even after he's enlightened, you know, wants to look up. Yeah, there's the instinct to look up. There's that sense of, you've got to look up. So here's the poem. I think continually of those who were truly great, who from the womb remembered the soul's history through corridors of light, where the hours are suns, endless and singing, whose lovely ambition was that their lips, still touched with fire, should tell of the spirit clothed from head to foot in song, and who hoarded from the spring branches the desires falling across their bodies like blossoms. What is precious is never to forget the essential delight of the blood drawn down from ancient springs, breaking through rocks in worlds before our earth. Never to deny its pleasure in the morning simple light, nor its grave evening demand for love. Never to allow gradually the traffic to smother with noise and fog the flowering of the spirit. Near the snow, near the sun, in the highest fields, see how these names are fated by the waving grass and by the streamers of white cloud and whispers of wind in the listening sky. The names of those who in their lives fought for life, who wore at their hearts the fire centre. Born of the sun, they travelled a short while toward the sun and left the vivid air signed with their honour. Thank you.